When the legend becomes fact, print the legend.
What the hell happened to the America that I've known and loved? Right, we sent rockets to photograph the rectal passages of Jupiter, and the kids wind up in porno film. They violate the laws of Newton and Christ, and then we wonder why. A bunch of bandits with towels on their heads have got us by the nuts.
A city rich in romantic oriental lore.
You want answers.
I want the truth. You can't handle the truth.
Baghdad, you must investigate Baghdad.
And learn a few of the facts you never knew before.
You both were members of Skull and Bones, a secret society at Yale. What does that tell us?
Not much, because it's a secret.
Is there a secret handshake? Is there a secret code?
I wish there were something secret I could manifest.
322, a secret number?
There are all kinds of secrets.
Welcome back to Cloak and Dagger. I'm your host, Lenny Bloom, along with my co-host, the great Judge Buster and barn burner from Chicago, Sherman Skolnick. Sherman, welcome to the show.
I'm honored again to be on with you, Lenny, and greatly honored to have an expert on such matters as the Federal Reserve as Eustace Mullins. I'm glad we're able to reach you, and in the past, because of sabotage by the phone company, instead of your phone ringing, the phone rang in a distant place, not you.
Oh, yeah, it was an intercept.
Welcome to Cloak and Dagger, Eustace. It's wonderful to have you here to quote Sherman. You're a real treasure of wisdom, and we're looking forward to getting your briefing.
All right, well, we're right on top of things.
Go ahead, Sherman. Sherman, what do you want to talk about? Where do you want to start?
Where do you think the Federal Reserve is taking us currently?
Well, in fact, it's taking us down the tubes, because I just sent out a flyer, and it's on my website, that the Internal Revenue Service here in the States is collecting on the false pretenses. It says IRS, the Department of the Treasury, and the Federal Reserve Act of 1913 specifically provided that the Department of the Treasury would no longer be the fiscal agent of the United States, and the sole fiscal agent since 1913 has been the Federal Reserve System.
What is a fiscal agent?
A fiscal agent is a person that handles the money. It's a very responsible position.
And settles their...
Eustace, if you were running a small business, would you put in charge as your fiscal agent to count the money someone not authorized under the rules of your business?
Well, they are authorized by the Federal Reserve Act of 1913, but it's totally phony, because you have to have a responsible fiscal agent who can be answered to for whatever he does. And we have a private bank, the Federal Reserve System, privately owned bank, which is in sole charge of all tax collection in the United States.
By the way, in a rare decision, the Federal Appeals Court in San Francisco in recent years has ruled exactly what you say, that the Federal Reserve is a private, not U.S. government entity. A woman somehow tripped and fell on the stairs of the Federal Reserve District Bank in San Francisco, and she sued the government. And the Federal Appeals Court says you can't do that because the Federal Reserve is a private
a private company.
And it's not the government. Well, that's an important thing, Eustace, because...
Well, people don't realize that. Nobody realizes this in Canada or the United States. They simply cannot get it through their heads that they're dealing with a private bank.
Well, the reason for that, to be brief, is that many of the key federal judges in America are what we call banker judges.
Oh, they certainly are. They have bank stock.
Right, and they don't want to rule on the question of the Federal Reserve. So if somebody raises it in court, they say it's frivolous, and they throw you out of court without a ruling.
Yeah,
anyway, proceed on the way you're proceeding.
Well, it's not frivolous, but it is a conflict of interest for a judge who has stock in the banks that own the Federal Reserve to rule on anything regarding the Federal Reserve system. I mean, that's an open conflict of interest, but they won't say that. They say it's frivolous.
Is it clear to you, Eustace, without more facts, that such a judge, that in his crooked court, if he acts like that, where his bank is in his court, that in his court you cannot win? In other words, I don't have to say much more than that, do I?
No, you certainly do not.
Yeah, go ahead. Tell us more, Eustace.
Well, I spent the last 50 years studying the Federal Reserve night and day, and I became such an authority on it that I was never once ever called before a congressional committee to testify on this, although I'd written the only history of the Federal Reserve System. And I got my first chance. I came to Canada, and I was helping a guy in Vernon, British Columbia, who was the Canada Revenue was really going to crucify this guy. He had a small cattle and lumber operation there in B.C., and they were going to just take everything he had. And so a friend of his paid my way to Canada to come and testify for him. I testified for 4 hours, and Canada Revenue dropped all charges against him.
What do you make of that? Are you telling me that Canada does not have banker judges like America?
They have banker judges, but they also have a very important difference than the United States. A private citizen can appear as a paralegal in Canada as strictly against the law in the United States.
Well, wait a minute, Eustace. There is no such law. It's judge-made out of the sky.
Well, it really is. It's made for their own convenience, for the convenience of the Bar Association.
The whole thing of corporations and others requiring a lawyer is relatively new to America. In the beginning of this great country, any person, a relative or friend, could speak for another friend in court. And then somewhere in the later part of the 19th century, they put this Save the Lawyers from Bankruptcy Committee. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, yes, indeed.
You have to have a lawyer.
You have to have a lawyer, yes.
If you come without a lawyer, they look down their nose at you. And they create this thing out of the sky. Oh, it's frivolous. Get the hell out of here. Yeah, go ahead. Tell us about it. So in other words, they won in Canada. That's a point in favor of Canada, isn't it?
Oh, yes.
Well, go ahead, Eustace.
Well, we have the Uniform Commercial Code, UCC, in this country also. And a friend of mine is suing an automobile company for fraud because they overcharged him on a transmission. And so he, under the Uniform Commercial Code, he sent a letter to the judge, to the sheriff, the county sheriff, telling him to get his car back. They'd taken his car illegally. And the sheriff replied that he had to have a court order, which is nonsense, because under the UCC, if you're operating on the UCC, you don't go through the court at all. So he's at a Mexican standoff right now, and he's trying to get this sheriff to conform to law.
What it sounds like to me, Eustace, is the way the courts purportedly have operated in Mexico going back to the revolution of 1910.
I mean, yeah.
In other words, Americans like to criticize other countries and other courts like they did with the Ukraine thing. They had a panel discussion on a TV show, and they said, everybody understands that the Ukraine Supreme Court is corrupt. What about the U.S. Supreme? You know what I'm saying?
Well, the U.S. Supreme Court is the most corrupt of all because you have to be a political hack to be appointed to the Supreme Court. And if you're not a hack, you'll never get on the Supreme Court. Every lawyer knows that.
What would you do if you were the chief judge of the U.S. Supreme Court? By some mystery, they opened the gates and they let you be there. What would you do or say that might help America?
Well, that's a good question.
Well, I would honor the law, because that's what I'm supposed to do. But the Supreme Court justices we have now just ignore the law, because they've gone beyond the law. There is no law as far as they're concerned.
So in other words, you and I could probably point to a number of cases where the bankers win because the banker judges are sitting on the court.
Yes, where you could point to every case and prove that, any case that comes up. Because that's the sole criterion, is that they rule in favor of the judges rule in favor of the banks in which they have stock.
I think it would be useful to the listeners, since you've had 50 years of experience, what has the Federal Reserve in the past done, in your judgment, that brought on the Great Depression of the 1930s, and are they doing something like that now? If you have any knowledge about that, tell us.
Well, I have plenty of knowledge about it, because you mentioned San Francisco a minute ago, and you know the consultant to the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco is Milton Friedman, who has been one of the outspoken critics of the Federal Reserve for many years.
Really?
He says the Federal Reserve has done everything wrong, and he points to the crash of 29 and everything since then. He says they've done everything wrong. Well, they've done everything wrong, but everything they've done has been right for the banks.
What did they do, if you could summarize, especially for young people who that's so far back there, what did the Federal Reserve do, in your judgment, that brought on the Depression? Tell us.
Well, that's explained in depth in my book, because I got government documents. They had hearings on the Great Depression, and they found out that the Depression occurred because the Federal Reserve Board of Governors acted to help England with its gold shipments.
Really?
And that was the sole criterion that brought on the great crash of 1929.
Totally, quite all right. Nothing wrong with skinning the colonies in order to keep the mothership afloat.
Well, it is a colonial operation. The Federal Reserve has acted as a colonial agency for the Bank of England throughout the operation of the Federal Reserve System.
Cheerio, Eustace. Good boy, good show. Keep it quiet, won't you?
I'm sure you're aware of it, Eustace, because you have so many years of experience, and we're honored that you brought this wisdom to our program. In the 1930s, let's remind everybody that there was only one congressman, McFadden, that spoke out against the Federal Reserve, and he did it for a number of years until they poisoned him. And
they poisoned him that suddenly. And
tell
he
tell
was
us a little bit about that.
Well, that was out-and-out murder, because Congressman McFadden was a very brilliant man in Washington, but everybody was terrified of him because he would speak the truth and speak his mind and criticize these criminals, and so everybody was scared to death of him. I remember a good friend of mine, George Simpson, who was the founder of the National Press Club in Washington and the most respected man in Washington. I asked him about Lewis McFadden one day. This was about 1955. And he said, well, everybody said that Lewis McFadden was insane. You know, he called for the impeachment of President Hoover, the Secretary of the Treasury, and the entire Federal Reserve Board of Governors. And so they said he must be insane. And he wasn't insane at all. He was reporting a crime, which you're supposed to do by law.
In the period after World War II, I'm going to mention two congressmen, and tell the listeners if you agree with my opinion. We had a populist from Texas named Congressman Wright Patman.
Oh, he was a very good friend of mine.
Tell us a little bit about him.
Well, Congressman Patman wrote me an unsolicited letter about 1958 saying that, Dear Mr. Mullins, I have your book. Your book is the only on the Federal Reserve System is the only book that I have on my desk, and I refer to it constantly. And he was the chairman of the Banking and Currency Committee. He's known today as a populist, but he really was just a good American.
Then there is a current congressman from Texas, Ron Paul.
Yeah, he's a good friend of mine also, and he's also a lone wolf, like Congressman McFadden and like Wright Patman, who succeeded him.
And then there was a Louisiana congressman, Rarick.
Oh, John Rarick, I know well, too, and John Rarick is a very fine man.
They suddenly, from nowhere, came up with a competitor for his district and ran him out.
Sherman, let's let Eustace finish his point. Go ahead.
Go ahead, Eustace. Go ahead.
Oh, John Rarick was hounded out of Congress because he consistently spoke against the Federal Reserve System. And they just had to get rid of him.
Yes.
So they finally did.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any other congressman that you could currently point to?
Well, Congressman Ron Paul is a good friend of mine, also from Texas, and he is the lone voice. They never allow more than one congressman in any administration to speak against, not to expose the Federal Reserve System. And today it's Ron Paul. And when he votes for a bill, he votes alone. No one will vote with him. That's the way it was with Wright Patman, and that's the way it was with Lewis McFadden. When you oppose this criminal conspiracy... Now, I have told my audiences for years that the Federal Reserve System is not federal, no more so than Federal Express, and it has no reserves because it doesn't need any reserves. When you can create money out of nothing, which the governors of the Federal Reserve have testified before Congress, that's what they do. They create money out of nothing. So if you can create money out of nothing, you don't need any reserves.
But the thing is, it's a hijacking of that operation and that power. It's a hijacking of that power by a criminal elite network of thugs.
Well, it certainly is. And they hijack the money and credit of the people of the United States.
Yes, they've hijacked their wealth, and it's in effect, it's a ongoing pickpocket operation.
Yes.
Who do you blame for this?
Well, I blame the original Woodrow Wilson, who signed the Federal Reserve Act in law. His birthplace is about four blocks from where I'm sitting talking to you right now, and he's the only hero of this little town in Virginia. So,
and so he's the scoundrel who gave away and allowed the hijacking.
Well, he did that because the international criminals needed a world war. And they couldn't have a world war since 1885 because the European countries were already bankrupted by their central banks. So the only country in the world before 1914 that could afford to go to war was the United States. And so they put the Federal Reserve Act through Congress just before Christmas in 1913. And lo and behold, in 1914, we had our world war.
Now, did these families have any expertise in pickpocketing and fleecing? And were they criminal beforehand? Like, how did they, how was it they were able to pull off such a pickpocket operation?
Well, because these were professional criminals. These were lifelong criminals. Because the mastermind behind the creation of the Federal Reserve System was John D. Rockefeller, who was already operating the greatest monopoly in the world, Standard Oil Company of New Jersey. And he was making so much money, he was looking for other investments. So he decided to hijack the entire money and credit system of the United States in order to have a place to put all of his profits on the Standard Oil Company.
Now, how could you hijack it?
Well, it's quite simple. In the Federal Reserve Act, Section 34, the last paragraph, the Federal Reserve Act of 1913, it says, and this was added as a SOP to get it passed through Congress, it says, Congress reserves the right to alter or repeal this act at any time. Now, that is in the Federal Reserve Act, and it has never been employed by anyone, because whenever one congressman gets up and speaks about the Federal Reserve System, they cut him off at the pass. They make sure that nobody joins him.
Eustace, there are 12 Federal Reserve District banks, and the one that is the kingpin of the 12 is the New York Federal Reserve District Bank.
Yeah, it's the only one that has two seats on the Federal Open Market Committee.
Now,
the other districts only are allowed one seat.
Tell us now, a little bit about that.
Before we go into that, Sherman, I have another question that I want to ask Eustace. Eustace, let me ask you this. This thing, other nations hold Federal Reserve currency and use that currency. I presume that they were aware of what you're saying. and the real history of the Federal Reserve, or is that not true? And
well, they have to know it. They absolutely could not operate with it if they didn't know it.
So what made them go along with it as well, rather than say, no, we don't want that currency. If you're going to buy stuff from us, we want an actual note from a publicly sanctioned, publicly owned credit creation or a bank.
Well, the reason that everybody went along with it, that they asked to go along with it,
right,
was quite simple. There's a gentleman who takes you up on top of the mountain, and he shows you the whole world, and he says, all this can be yours.
I see.
So people cannot resist a pitch like that.
Right.
And that's the simple, that's the way it's done. They say you can have all the money in the world, you can be the richest man in the world, and it's very simple. Just go along with us, and you're on your way.
Right.
That's all there is to it. There's no moral issue,
yeah,
no legal issue. There's nothing except pure greed.
Yeah.
The other thing is that the monopoly press...
the monopoly press is owned by...
the owners of the Fed.
Oh, yeah, by the owners of the Fed.
But notice what they do to promote this fairy tale. They don't call it Federal Reserve notes. In fact, Lenny, I wish you wouldn't use the word currency. Federal Reserve paper.
Paper.
It's printed toilet paper.
I appreciate you. I stand corrected. Sorry, Sherman. I'll make sure I don't say that again.
Let me not fall in with the mass media lie.
Right.
The other thing that they do to us, Eustace, is they keep hollering and hollering the U.S. dollar. Currently, there is no such thing.
No, the U.S. dollar is gone long ago. I think it vanished in 1913, really.
Yeah, exactly.
But what I'm saying is, when they talk about the euro and all of this, they promote this fairy tale that there is some kind of a thing out there, an instrument called the U.S. dollar.
Yeah.
So people grow up, they go to college, they get a Ph.D., and they keep mouthing off the same thing.
Well, it's mythology. This is like talking about Zeus and Mount Olympus, because it's just as related to reality as that.
Some contend that the Federal Reserve, in the face of the growing unemployment following the market crash of 29, that the Federal Reserve kept raising the interest rates for a principle that is seldom discussed in the press called hemorrhaging. In other words, they wanted to prevent the hemorrhaging of American funds leaving the country. And the only classical way to do that is to raise the interest rates to keep the paper money here. Is there something like that happening now?
It certainly is, and this is what's going on at the present time. The Federal Reserve has just raised the interest rate again 6 times in a row. Now, the last time they did this in the year 2000, they raised it 6 times in a row, Greenspan. We had the same chairman that we had. He's doing it again. He did it 6 times in 2000, and the American people lost $8 trillion from the depredations of the Federal Reserve System. And we've been in a recession ever since, because the withdrawal of this $8 trillion from the American economy has left this entire nation totally poverty-stricken. Until we can get that $8 trillion back, we're doomed. We can't do anything.
Well, I, for one, predict that the interest rates on the so-called government side will go as high as 8%.
Oh, yes, they're on the way up.
You have been at this so many years. What do you foresee or predict down the road at the hands of the Federal Reserve regarding the interest rates and so on? Tell us what you understand.
Well, your prediction of 8% is actually very accurate. It's coming to that. It'll take another two or three years to do it. But they're shooting for 8%, because if you're a banker, you certainly want 8% on your money rather than 2%, which they got now, and which until very recently they're only getting 1%. And you can see that this is very painful to be a banker and to get 1% interest when you can get beginning 8 or 10.
Well, what do you make of these people that reshuffled their mortgage at these lower rates? In the process, for a period there, the so-called price of real estate went up and up and up. Now, you've been around a long time. You're a senior citizen. What do you see is deadly about that situation?
Well, what they're saying right now for the last 3 months, they've been talking about a real estate crash. And there is no real estate crash in Elfing because the price of the real estate is more or less permanent, and it's going up, not down. So there's no crash as possible under the circumstances. But I think the insiders are using this to make even more money in real estate because they're trying to frighten people into selling their real estate at the current prices when they know it'll be double that in 2 or 3 years.
Well, but Eustace, you say that there won't be a crash. Real estate is the only free market in America not subject to monopoly, and there are places like California where an ordinary house costs $800,000. Are you saying that that is a fair price and that that's going to stay like that?
Well, I'm saying it's a market price, not a fair price. It's not a fair market price, but it is a fair price on the present market. Now, today's Washington Post had a real estate section. It was on the front page, actually, in which a retired person in Washington, D.C., his taxation rate on his house has just been revalued from $500,000 to $1,400,000. And he's a retired man, and he cannot afford to pay against that valuation. So he's going to be forced out of his home.
But under the current policies of the Federal Reserve, as you understand them, are we facing a prosperity or the opposite?
We're facing the greatest prosperity that we've known since 1920. And it
really
seems inevitable. I think the re-election of George Bush paved the way for that, because now the insiders are going to go in and clean up during his administration, which they weren't able to do during the last administration of George Bush just ended, because they got involved in this Iraq war. But they are planning to go ahead and attack Iran, Syria, and Saudi Arabia and keep the war going. And the fact is that our economy cannot stand the cost of this war. They just asked for $450 billion. There's going to be a $450 billion deficit.
Well, no, am I to take you serious that you're predicting prosperity right around the corner, or are you sort of...
I am predicting prosperity under the present setup. They set this up, and they intend to clean up during the next 3 or 4 years, the insiders.
But
they've got everything set up the way they want it. They've got the Congress under control. They've got the Democrats crying in the wind. They can't do anything about anything. And so the Republicans can do whatever they want during the next 4 years.
But will there be prosperity for the common people?
I don't think the common people know, because you have the central bank in England, the Bank of England, and I've been over to England, and the people are shabby. This money from these central bank insiders, the billionaires, does not percolate down to the people.
I think maybe, Sherman, what Eustace is saying is what Leonard Cohen is saying. The rich are going to get richer and the poor are poorer.
Under this system, they certainly are. And the poor are bound to get poorer because the poor do not have any way of participating in this prosperity, in this redistribution of wealth.
Well, redistribution for the benefit of whom?
For the benefit of a small group of insiders who know what's going on.
So when you use the word prosperity, you don't mean in the broad sense.
I don't mean in the broad sense. I mean in the very narrow sense.
Prosperity for the very wealthy, but not for the common people, right?
Not at all, because, well, you got more billionaires today than ever, and billionaires were inconceivable. You know, a person who was a millionaire in 1900 was fabulously wealthy, wealthier than any billionaire today. And so we've gone from millionaire to billionaire, and it means less all the time.
So the prosperity that you envision is, we must be more specific, prosperity for the 1 or 2%, the ultra-rich that own and operate most everything.
Oh, yeah, that's why the Democrats all through this last campaign were harping on the fact that everything Bush was doing was for the 1% of the wealthiest families, which is certainly true, but it wasn't the taxation policy itself. It was the whole Federal Reserve system.
In your opinion, you've been studying this for 50 years, is the common man getting the drift of this, or...
Well, I think he knows that the cards are getting stacked against him. If you start a small business today, the chances are that you will fail because you simply do not have access to the capital to build up your business and to maintain it for a period of time.
Well, what kind of business could someone go into? You can't compete with Walmart. They have slave labor.
That's true. And they can't compete with the General Motors because they have the markets under control. They won't allow any competition.
Do you use Internet yourself, Eustace?
I don't, but I should. I've got a website now, but I'm going to move into the... I want to become a blogger. That's my current ambition because I want to...
Give us your website address, if you wish.
It's EustaceMullins.com.
Spell it for us.
EustaceMullins.com.
And, of course, we have, since you're listening, Sherman, once again, everybody who's listening to the show has already gone to cloakanddagger.ca. And, well, if you're listening to the show right now, just take a look at your computer screen and look to the right-hand column, and you'll see Eustace's name. And you don't even have to know the answer to Sherman's question. You can just click on that link. See, Sherman, we're dumbing them down all the time.
I noticed something here. Nowadays, when you have technical difficulty with your email or your website, if you go through the computer menus carefully enough, you finally end up with an actual human being, and it's most often a Chinese woman at the other end of the world that does, in many instances, has a lot of patience and deals with you. And so what they're doing by satellite is sending business yonder. Therefore, the ordinary people will not participate in this prosperity.
No, it shuts them out completely.
In other words, in fact, we should be careful using the word prosperity because some darn fools out there think that we're talking about prosperity.
Well, can we? What about the word stagflation? Well,
stagflation is fine because that's just what we've got.
Stagflation. It's not prosperity, Sherman.
No, I.
It'll be a new form of feudal economics in which
feudal economics. That's exactly what it is.
The barons, and the sheriff is. If you're a sheriff, you've got a good job because you work for the baron, and the barons are getting wealthier, and the common folk, the serfs, are getting poorer. But the barons are well off, and they're going to be more well off than ever before.
Well, they certainly are, because everything's going to come to them.
So you predict interest rates as high as 8%.
Oh, yes, certainly.
What impact will that have on the common people?
Well, it's going to be ruinous to the common people because they can't afford to drive. They can't afford to buy Rockefeller's gas to drive to work every day. So it's going to be very tough for them.
The end of the motor car industry or just refinement? A lot of junk cars are going to be created?
Oh, yeah. A lot of people have to get rid of their cars because they can't afford to use them.
Use them. So that's interesting. There may be opportunities for people there, Eustace, in liquidating used cars somehow, turning it into some other product?
Well, in the 1950s, I was living in Jersey City, New Jersey, and you could buy beautiful Nash Ambassador limousines for $100 a piece.
Wow.
And they were very nice cars. And they did that again when they cut the gas off back in the 60s. And you could buy Cadillacs in perfect shape for $100 and $150.
Motorcycles will become a bigger thing, will it?
More motorcycles, definitely.
Yes.
In the oil crisis of the late 1970s, what came forward...
Oh, people were giving away their beautiful Cadillacs in those days. Lincolns and Cadillacs, you could pick them up anywhere.
Let me tell you what happened. Cynical people didn't give away anything.
Well, nobody who really has money has to give away anything.
They shoved their car into the canal and said that they listed the car as stolen.
Oh, they set fire to them sometimes. They still do that occasionally.
In Boston, they found 12 brand-new Buicks in the river. And here in Chicago, there's a canal, and they found in one of the suburbs, all the police, including the chief of police, had gotten rid of their gas guzzler by letting him go overboard into the canal.
So we'll have an
Canal, the canal got blockaded, and they finally, in dredging the canal, they came up with 8 cars belonging to the local police. They pushed all the cars into the canal.
Eustace, the bicycle industry will take off again?
Oh, no, this is not a bicycle country. That's Europe.
So when they give up their cars because they can't financially afford them, will that enhance the violence? Increase violence?
Well, because when people can't go to and from work, they get violent.
And if you're driving an SUV in an American city and there's now another 400 or 500 people on the street who no longer can afford their cars, are they going to start throwing rocks at the others?
No, they're not going to throw rocks. They're going to hijack your car. They're going to get in and shove a gun in your face and say, get out. And drive off with the SUV.
Right.
You've got vast experience, Eustace.
Well, I've lived in the United States.
Tell us something. The very rich trying, it seems to me anyway, I want to see what you say, are they trying to set off an insurrection or a revolution which they feel they can control? Because how long are the American common people could allow themselves to be tormented in this way? That's the point.
Well, they've allowed this since 1787, actually. But, you know,
they're asleep.
The rich boys in the early 1930s were terrified of a national revolution because the streets were full of unemployed people and they would do anything. So they took care of that, the New Deal, and FDR took care of that. Everything that FDR did, said Milton Friedman, prolonged the Depression and made it worse during the 1930s. And he was saved by Adolf Hitler.
Eustace, some of us old-timers, when we mention that the ultra-rich built machine gun nests around their house in the 1930s, they think that we're getting potty and fuddy-duddy. But in other words, the ultra-rich were really worried.
Oh, they were, yes.
Well, what did they do from what you may have observed?
Well, they were treated into their, well, what we have now in the United States is gated communities. You have gated communities with armed guards, because, and more people are living like this in New York and California today, because they're afraid of the common people, and they realize that revenge may be coming.
So one of these days, you or I, or maybe, well, Letty's in Canada, he's not going to see that. We'll pick up the real estate section, and they'll have houses with gated communities, and if times get bad, gated communities surrounded by machine gun nests.
Well, they've got those now.
Wait a minute, Eustace, before you laugh, you have come to Washington, and you know there are machine gun nests built into the street around the Justice Department building. I bet you've seen them.
Oh, yes. Well, I remember sitting in the National Press Club with George Simpson, its founder, in 1948, and he was telling me that he was visited by a reporter went to the State Department, and behind the door were men with machine guns in the State Department in 1948. They were expecting a revolution at any minute. And, of course, George Bush has turned Washington to the biggest armed camp in the world.
What do you suppose the very rich think about people like you and me and so on? We talk about these things and we even joke about them.
Well,
what is their reaction if you've come across it?
Their reaction is, we must be nuts. Why don't we, if we know what's going on, why don't we get in and profit by it like everybody else? That's the way they look at the thing.
Well, how could the common people profit from this situation?
Well, they couldn't. The common people would have
to... No, he's not talking about the common people. He's talking about just those like yourself, Sherman, and Eustace, who can see the wizard's back.
Yes. They always called us muckrakers. You know, Theodore Roosevelt denounced us as muckrakers in 1900, and they call us troublemakers. And the FBI watches us very carefully. I was under personal daily surveillance by the FBI for 33 years.
Really?
Because I had visited Ezra Pound, who was being held in without trial for 13 years in St. Elizabeth's Hospital in Washington, and they felt that anybody that was associated with a man like that is too dangerous to be out on the street.
I recall from a previous time we had you on that earlier in your career, you associated with some very important people. In fact, some of them could have been considered very wealthy. What, did you learn anything from associating with such people?
No. I was the confidant of H.L. Hunt, the richest person in the world, in 1959. And Hunt moved me into his private office, and I had the desk next to his. And we liked each other's company. And I always found H.L. Hunt to be a delightful companion, because if you never ask him for any money, you get along with him fine. And that was the tip-off. I knew that instinctively. Nobody had to tell me that, because I'd known quite a few other wealthy people, and I learned that you didn't ask them for money.
Because he wanted to help us form a group called the Citizens Committee to Clean Up the Courts. Likewise, told me for many years that he was a friend of H.L. Hunt, and he said that H.L. Hunt was a very strange super billionaire, very strange.
He was a super billionaire, and he was strange, although I never found him strange at all, because I was with him 24 hours a day. And we got along very well.
Was that in Texas? Where was would that have been?
That was in Dallas, yes, at Dallas, at the mansion. He built a mansion. There was a copy of Mount Vernon, only it was four times as large. And it's now, his widow sold it after he died, his children sold it, to a black preacher named H.L. Jakes.
Now, how many children did he have, and how were they able to remain? Did they have the understanding and wisdom of the father?
Oh, not at all.
No, they were just
they didn't have it at all. And in fact, this was quite a burden to H.L. Hunt, because his children could not. Well, he was a professional gambler for years. He'd seen everything and done everything. But then his children did not have any of that experience.
Yeah, exactly.
And there was no way they could get it.
Go ahead, Sherman.
Answer to Lenny's question. In 1980 and 81, they had a silver price collapse. Bunker Hunt, that's one of his sons,
had
run
Bunker
up the
Herbert.
Price of silver to $51 an ounce.
Oh, yeah.
When it crashed to $10 an ounce, he went into bankruptcy, and he had to pledge as assets even his Rolex watch.
Oh, indeed.
So H.L. Hunt's sons did not have any sense of how to hold on to the money. They lost everything. Am I right?
They were babes in the woods. They simply, you see, H.L. Hunt was one of the best gamblers in the world, and he knew always to cover your bets. But his sons, his children never knew any of that. They don't know it today. And they have had they've gone through one disaster after another. He gave each one of them $100 million when they turned 21 in the 1950s, which is equivalent to $1 billion today. And he thought that would get them off to a good start in life. And it didn't help them that much, because they made all the wrong moves.
They lost it all.
No, they didn't lose it all. They're still billionaires, but they didn't do very well with it.
What do you make of the ultra-rich now as compared to the ultra-rich that formed this conspiracy called the Federal Reserve? Have you compared the current ultra-rich with those from years ago?
Those ultra-rich, like John D. Rockefeller and J.P. Morgan, were real predatory people. Now, the ultra-rich today are not that predatory, but they're still out for whatever they can get, but they don't have the wiles and the determination that people like J.P. Morgan and John D. Rockefeller had.
Yeah, they've been spoiled by the money, and they're fat cat and lazy.
Oh, they really have.
And they become slaves to the fashion industry, then become propaganda and be brainwashed just like the sheeple.
But let's be careful here. The ultra-rich, even today, are not nice, sweet people.
You're not listening carefully to what I'm saying, Sherman. I'm not saying that they, we're not judging them on that. We're just saying that they no longer have the wizard's back. They've lost the percepts and understanding that was resonant within the father.
Well, because they're repeating the same techniques. You have to modify your techniques from time to time. They're still doing the same thing they did in 1929.
Yeah, there you go. And same thing.
We're headed down the same road. Exactly.
Rearview mirror bunch. They become rearview mirror as well.
Oh, yes.
The privatizing of the Social Security system.
Oh, yes. That's right. That's right down the line.
Tell us, isn't that some kind of a Federal Reserve trick of some kind?
Well, it certainly is, because now everybody's going to put everything they've got in the hands of their stockbroker. The same guy who took them through 1929 and the year 2000. And you're going to, your old age is going to depend entirely on what these guys do with your money. And they're going to do the same thing with it they've always done.
A guy called
steal it.
A guy called into a talk show last night, and he gave very good advice. He says, you know, your broker says, turn over the money to me, and I'll buy shares, and I'll keep them for you. And all you got is a receipt. Now, if the broker goes bust, you don't have the share certificate, so what real proof do you have that you ever had shares?
No, you're operating in the dark because you don't have anything. I've been through this with stockbrokers, and I tried to sell my stocks out and on January the 15th of the year 2000. And he refused to sell my stocks. And so he held those stocks right up to October, and most of my capital vanished into thin air.
Well, but wait a minute, Eustace. Maybe he wasn't legit with you. There's a thing called hypothecate. It's a nice broker's term. What it means is he took your shares and pledged them somewhere else and didn't tell you about it.
Oh, yes, he was probably doing all kinds of things with them. But in other words, he's locked in. He could not sell my stocks.
Have you assumed that maybe the stocks are not even there anymore?
Well, I don't know if they were ever there or not. All I know is that I took a $30,000 investment, and it went up to $750,000. But I never saw any of the money.
Well, the bread and circus shows continue as Romanism rises in American politics.
Do you foresee the time, Eustace, when the American people will wise up, if ever, and throw off the Federal Reserve, or that's just wishful thinking on the rest of us types?
Well, it's not wishful thinking. It's the obvious thing to do in this dilemma that we're in. And you see, what you had, I have a two-page article from the Washington Post from George Bush, the first administration, and this writer had a full page of Nicholas Brady, and who was one of the biggest operators on Wall Street, and he said he is George Bush Sr.'s only advisor. He asked him, he tells him everything to do, and that's where the Bushes were coming from.
Well, maybe it's not a dilemma. Maybe it's a trilemma.
Well,
or even more.
Well, I call it the $8 trillion heist. You know, the New York Times said that between March and November of the year 2000, the insiders took $8 trillion away from the American people. And I call it the biggest heist in history. And nobody has been arrested for it yet. Nobody ever will be.
Yep. The parade of swindles continues, Sherman, and we have that on our website at click on the info, show info button on the left-hand side, and you can see more about the parade of swindles. Sherman, you're an expert in the parade of swindles.
I know, but Eustace, you have studied the beginning of the Federal Reserve.
The very beginning.
And you've seen it continue over the years. In your opinion, and you're an expert, short of a revolution, we cannot be rid of the Federal Reserve. Is that a fair statement?
Well, as Ezra Pound told me in an insane asylum in 1948, he said that any attempt to take away this money-making privilege from these people, you're going to meet with very serious resistance.
What does that mean?
Well, it means they'll fight to the death to keep those operations going.
Yeah, they like the branding on their cow, and they're not going to let you change it, Sherman. They'll even kill the cow. They'll even kill the cow.
They'll kill the cow. They'll make money doing that.
You probably have had this happen, but tell us about it. I have run into people from the Wharton School of Business.
Oh,
my
God.
They learn about the Federal Reserve, and they're so misguided about the thing. Have you run into some of those people, and if you discuss the Federal Reserve, they don't know what you're really talking about?
They really don't, because I don't think they ever mentioned the Federal Reserve System at the Wharton School of Business. And I know that the Baker School of Business at Harvard University, George Baker, who was J.P. Morgan's partner, he put $25 million in cash in 1922 to set up the Baker School of Business. And that's where the Federal Reserve System was refined to what it is today.
So in other words, these people that study at business schools, and they get a thing called an MBA, a Master of Business Administration, you don't have much confidence in that, do you?
Well, I've seen articles in Fortune magazine. They say that the problem with the whole business of the United States is that it's devoted to short-term profits. And you cannot build a business on short-term profits. You build a business with service and integrity over a period of years. You don't build it on short-term profits. But everything is geared to the schools of business for quick short-term profits so that the chairman of the board looks good and gives himself a big bonus. And that's what it's all about.
Have you heard of this movement in the western states of the United States where some enterprising people, on a hypothetical basis, say, well, the Federal Reserve can create money out of nothing, so they says, we're going to create money. And so they create something, their own banknotes, and they sell them.
Oh, those people were acting on instructions from my book. I've worked with them over the years. Most of them are in jail now because they finally locked them up, and they wouldn't give them any lawyers. They wouldn't give them any trials. They've been locked up. In fact, that was the Freeman up in Montana, and the FBI was closing in on them. And so they called me, and they said, Eustace, if we acted on the information in your book, which they did, and they said, now, they're coming to We may shoot it out with the FBI because they're closing in, but if we surrender to them, will you come and testify for them? And I said, yes, I'll testify for you.
I mean, legally and technically, they're correct. The Federal Reserve creates money. It costs them about 3 cents each note to print it, whether it's a $1,000 Federal Reserve piece of toilet paper or a $1 one. So these other people from the western states says, well, if the Federal Reserve can do that, nobody stops it. We're going to print our own
money. Well, that's exactly what they did, yes.
And what happened? The government got all upset.
Well, they let them send some of this money in bonds around, and then they closed in on them, locked them all up. And they're still in jail today. They've never had a trial, and I guess they're in for life.
And what are they accused of?
Other than
being foolhardy.
I think they call it using false instruments.
False instruments. Well, what is Greenspan and the rest of them guilty of?
Well, the same thing. But they're better at it. They have got the mechanism to make it legitimate, or to make it appear legitimate in the eyes of the public. And these guys did not have that.
What I tell my friends in Canada nowadays is very cynical. I said, whatever you do, don't go near the U.S. border, please.
Well, the Canadians, I've lectured in Canada for years, you know, and the Canadians always complain to me that the U.S. is robbing them of all their income. And it's the U.S. is not doing this. This gang of insiders, the Federal Reserve people, are robbing the American people and the Canadian people of their income.
So in other words, they got some of these good-hearted people from the western states says, well, you see that the Federal Reserve types create money out of nothing. We're going to create money like that and sell it to our neighbors. So the FBI comes along and says, no, you can't do that. You're under arrest.
Well, they declare it illegal, and then they put you in jail. And the judges say, well, of course it's illegal because they said it was illegal.
We're laughing, but
I know a lot of those guys are in jail, and I feel bad about it because actually they were acting on my information and doing this. It's perfectly logical.
Yeah. So the criminal elite are basically a bunch of bankers.
Yeah, they're bankers, but they're a criminal elite because bankers originally were people of very upsetting character. You know, J.P. Morgan said, I don't consider anything in a man except his character when I make a loan to him.
I had a lawyer many years ago, and he had some old-time ideas. He says the way to run a bank years ago was to have three people like the Smith Brothers cough drops, each of them with a beard. I don't know about now, but 70, 80 years ago, if your bankers all had beards, they were considered to be trustworthy.
Yeah, J.P. Morgan was one of the very unusual bankers who did not have a beard.
Well, Eustace, we're running. We've got a few minutes left before we go. Why don't you just give us a heads up on what we should keep an eye on over the next few weeks, we'll certainly be looking forward to having you back. And what should everybody that's heard your briefing now? Do you think is there a particular book why don't you tell them about the books that you've got out right now at EustaceMullins.com?
Well, my book, The Federal Reserve, is out now, and I have a flyer on my website which tells you that when President Wilson signed the Federal Reserve Act into law in 1913, it provided in that Federal Reserve Act of 1913 that the Department of the Treasury would no longer be the fiscal agent of the United States government, but the sole fiscal agent would be the Federal Reserve System. So all income tax and all obligations of the government collected are trucked directly to a Federal Reserve Bank, to no other bank whatsoever, and that shows you a monopoly operation, and it also shows you that the government is collecting money, tax money from the American people under false pretenses, because that money should be collected by the fiscal agent of the government, and it is being collected by the fiscal agent, the Federal Reserve System, which is a privately owned bank, which has no business collecting any taxes from the American people. And so I circulated this a couple of weeks ago, and now the IRS has been calling me up and saying they have no tax returns from me for the last 5 years, which is utter nonsense because I file my returns, registered return receipt requested every year, because most lawyers do that, by the way, because if you don't do that, they can charge you with anything under the sun.
Where can the public get your book, Eustace?
Well, we've been through that. EustaceMullins.com, Sherman. You're used to radio rather than internet radio. Yeah. Eustace, thanks very much, so much for being on the show. It's just an honor to have you again with us. Members are just really blessed to be able to get this, and we want to, on behalf of all the members, thank you for coming on and sharing and giving us an update, and we look forward to having you on again very, very soon.
Well, it's a very vast subject because we could be on for hours and hours and hours on it, and it affects everybody in the United States. It's deep in the clutches of this operation, and there's no way they can get out of it.
We appreciate you brought your treasury of wisdom, sharing with us and our listeners.
All right.
And we want to have you again.
Well, the treasury is still open.
For the moment.
Yeah. Well, that's a day-to-day operation.
Thanks very much, Houston. Thank you.
I've enjoyed being with you.
We'll speak to you soon.
Righto.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
My closing remarks are the same. To hell with the Queen of England and the Federal Reserve.
Read it yourself instead of asking the government why, because that will cause the propaganda to die. Good night, Sherman.
Good night, everybody.
Everyone you know is a villain or a saint, living down in a hole or sitting high up on the pedestal. Black and white, the only colors that you ever paint, cause everyone you know is a villain or a saint. With a 10-gallon hat and a 2-ounce brain, you've been outselling lies to everyone. You're gonna civilize the whole damn world, is your home on the range. 10-gallon hat with a 2-ounce brain. Cowboy, cowboy, you ain't never seen a cow, but there ain't no one holier than thou. You're a back-slapping, gun-toting coward on the take, looking more like your enemy with every move you make. You'd sell us all to hell with an oily handshake, gun-toting, Bible-quoting fake. Cowboy, cowboy, you ain't never seen a cow. Nothing is more dangerous than a simple-minded man with the world on his plate, deciding everybody's fate. Evildoers hiding in the palm of his hand. No, nothing is more dangerous than a simple-minded man. Cowboy, cowboy, you ain't never seen a cow. Everyone you know is a villain or a saint, living down in a hole or sitting high up on the pedestal. Black and white, the only colors that you ever paint, 'cause everyone you know is a villain or a saint. With a 10-gallon hat and a 2-ounce brain, you've been outselling lies to everyone. You're gonna civilize the whole damn world. Is your home on the range? 10-gallon hat with a 2-ounce brain. Cowboy, cowboy, you ain't never seen a cow. But there ain't no one holier than thou. You're a back-slapping, gun-toting coward on the take, looking more like your enemy with every move you make. You'd sell us all to hell with an oily handshake, gun-toting, Bible-quoting fake. Cowboy, cowboy, you ain't never seen a cow. Nothing is more dangerous than a simple-minded man with the world on his plate, deciding everybody's fate. Evildoers hiding in the palm of his hand. No, nothing is more dangerous than a simple-minded man.